Well, I challenged him that if I put up 10 grand, we'd put up 10 grand for a Flint school. He gave me the money after the film was over. And we took the money and we built a computer lab in an elementary school in Flint where the poverty rate is like 87% in the school. 5% of the kids have a computer at home. 1% are on the internet. So we built this computer lab. And then a few months later, we're at home in New York watching TV, CNN. On comes this bulletin that there's been a shooting in Flint, Michigan. A six-year-old shoots a six-year-old to death. Remember that a couple years ago? That was at that school. They were on their way down to the computer lab in the school to use our computers. I said, why do you use 12-year-olds in these factories? And he got indignant. He goes, they're not 12, they're 14. Oh. Then he went on to some biological explanation how 14-year-olds there are different than 14-year-olds here. You know, it's like, he just kept digging himself deeper and deeper.
Did they really stop? Or I know the Workers' Rights Consortium is still after.
They stopped, but there's a lot of other things they need to do. The environment in the plants, the other things, they stopped the union organizing. I mean, I don't buy anything from Nike. But 4 weeks after the big one came out, Phil Knight was so humiliated by what he said in that film, he announced that he was ending all child labor in his Indonesian factories and credited the film for pushing him to do it.
Michael, how do you credit your tenacity? Where do you get the spirit going?
But that's why. If you grew up in an incredibly depressing place, you know, you either got to do some drugs to, you know, forget about it or get mad and do something, you know? No, I think, you know, Flint, I mean, Jesus, Flint. It's where the whole union movement started. 36-37 sit-down strike kicked off the whole union movement in this country. Started in Flint, Michigan. Flint, Michigan was the first city in the country to have a black mayor in the 60s, before Carl Stokes. It was the first city to do it. First city to have an open housing ordinance to make it illegal to discriminate in housing. It's always been a very kind of radical city in that way. So,
if there's like one problem or two or three problems worldwide that you've been kind of like naming, like kind of describe, that we should focus on in the world community, what would it be?
Well, this week we've got to work on stopping the violence in the Middle East. Well, if I were president.
Why are you president, Michael?
Because I want to live. Yeah.
My freshman year, we watched Roger and Me in class, in the sociology class for a couple of days. How did you get footage of those rabbits? Or those bunnies?
We were driving down the street, we saw the sign on a telephone pole, and we just saw it, pets or meat. That's how we felt in Flint, you know. First we were pets, and now we're meat. I thought it was a good metaphor, and I thought people should see, kind of, you know, here's a third world scene in the hometown of the world's richest corporation. You know, just how odd is that? People remember that bunny scene from Roger and Me, you know, and I get asked about it all the time. And a lot of people, you know, are upset, you know, by it and all that. I write that, pointed this out in the book, that not once in 10 years has anybody ever come up to me and said, I was so shocked by that black man that was shot in the film. 2 minutes after the Bunnies Club, the black man is shot by the police on camera. And I've never had a single person mention it to me. Because we accept that image. Black men are supposed to be shot. You know? That's right? We just accept it. There's another black guy getting shot. Horrified by the image. The little bunny rabbit guy. Oh. Think about that. This is really, it's sad that we're at that's where it goes, that's how dehumanized the situation becomes. You know? That's in this movie that I showed a clip of tonight, I deal a lot with that particular issue and how the media uses and exploits images of African Americans to create fear in white people, to get them essentially to do everything that conservatives want them to do. And of course that's why they end up buying 95% of the guns that are owned by white people in the suburbs. You know, a little known fact. It's like we're always in inner city. It's not true. The guns are in the suburbs, in the rural areas. Because they're afraid out there. They're afraid something, you know, might happen to them someday. And the face that's in the fear in their head of who might hurt them is not little freckled faced Jimmy. Whoever they perceive is going to hurt them is somebody else, the other, the wolf at the door, you know, the boogeyman. What do I think about what now? Marijuana?
I like marijuana.
Well, I don't know about legalizing, but I don't think it should be a crime. Well, I've never smoked a joint in my life, so I'm not a good person to ask. And I'm not saying I haven't done it for any, you know. I just ate my first tomato 2 years ago. So, you know, I'm slow. Already the attacks on the book so far, like on the internet and stuff, are not coming from conservatives or right wingers. They're coming from liberals, which I'm not surprised by. I mean, I think that's what I would expect, that either through jealousy, envy, or there's this old saying that the liberals are the cops for the right. The purpose of the liberal is to make sure that the political discussion does not veer any further than just a little bit left of center. So the liberal is a little bit left of center, right? And the liberal says, I'm defining what left is. When, of course, there's millions over here. But they're supposed to be marginalized and called the fringe. And the liberal's here. And the right wing needs the liberal to keep the political discourse from going any further left. Keep it just here, just in the center, somewhere a little left of center. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? So when I say I'm using liberal in a bad sense there, I mean the kind of typical liberal that, you know, just doesn't, you know, doesn't, keeps things from changing.
Paul Begala?
No, those kind of people. I got a couple scenes I never put in the movie that I wanted to put in. Because these auto workers were afraid of being laid off, so they wanted to get another job going quick. So all they knew was how to do an assembly line. So they set up, they invented the disposable kitty litter box. Right? You just use it once and you throw it away. And they created an assembly line in this guy's basement. They're all down there building these disposable kitty litter boxes. And it's like funny and sad at the same time. You know?
How do you think the next presidential election is going to be different from, obviously it will be totally different, but like how?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's going to be different in a way that we can't even predict right now.
Do you think that like Bush has a very good chance of like getting reelected compared to like a Democrat or a liberal or?
No, Bush is not going to win.
Gore's going to run again?
Yeah, Gore will run again. No, I don't think they want Gore.
Well, I remember being downsized in the chapter about Hillary. And I want to know what you think about what she's doing now, what you think about what she's going to do in the future, what you think she's going to do in the future.
You mean politically what she's doing now? Or you know, how she's looking now?
Because that was like my favorite chapter for Downsized, but...
Well, no, I still have my forbidden love for her. So I'm, she's done some good things. She's my senator, you know. We went to a fundraising party for her at a friend's house. He was hosting a thing to, you know, raise money for her when she was running. And we go over there, and she sees me, and I got my wife with me, right? And she's going, oh, I just want to thank you for what you said. You know, and she grabs my hand. This is a great picture of my wife and I have. She's like squeezing my hand, you know, and looking up at me admiringly. And my wife was on the other side of her looking like she's going to choke her, you know?
Do you think she's going to run for president?
Oh, yeah. Oh, she'll be president.
When do you think? When do you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. She'll be the first woman president. Yeah. Absolutely. That's exactly what's going to happen.
Before Elizabeth.
When?
People love her. Huh? Not this time.
The next time?
Next time. Or 12. She'll have to do some good stuff, though, you know, in the time. She can't just sit there and phone it in.
Yeah.
You know?
What do you do when you don't know, like, two candidates like on a ballot or two people you don't like or even three, like you don't have anybody you like to vote for? Do you like just not vote? Because I never thought it would be a good idea just not to vote.
No, you should vote. You should write somebody in. You already know way in advance that there's going to be good on the ballot, so you should run a write-in campaign for somebody or something. It'll get noticed. It'll get attention. If you get 1,500 people vote for this person or this, you know, whatever.
Two cartoon characters.
What you guys did here? You know?
Have you heard about that?
Oh yeah. I've got so many emails. Well, I'm gonna. I'm writing a fiction film actually, and then I'm gonna make another documentary. I think I'm gonna make it about the world after September 11th. All the stuff I was talking about tonight. And, you know, get to the bottom of some of this.
What type of problems have you run in against, like your show trying to broadcast that out? As there's only three media conglomerates now. I mean, are they pretty strict on, I mean, because your views are basically...
We have a lot of fights with the censors to get our stuff on. But I've always been able to get my TV shows on the air. They'll put me on if they believe they can make money. I just wrote a pilot for CBS that Ron Howard's producing. So, you know, it's, you know, I'm able to get my stuff out there. You know?
Conan O'Brien?
Again, they've refused to have me on for this book. I've been on Conan's show a dozen times. Yeah.
But not for this book.
And that will not have me on for this book. That's right. What I heard from Harper Collins was that the producer said the chemistry wasn't right between Conan and me. I've been on the show like a dozen times. I don't get it.
I've got a question.
Yeah.
You know, you've said that liberals kind of are sort of wimpy when it comes down to a lot of issues. And when you go on shows like Kennedy and Holmes or Bill O'Reilly, I mean, how come you don't just sock it to them and just say, look, you're full of air?
Oh, you haven't seen me? Why haven't you seen me on those shows then? You know? Have you seen me on those shows?
I saw you on Bill O'Reilly last time and he was asking you about what you thought.
Him up, man. Anybody see that? That was like brilliant, I thought, how I did that. I planned for months on how I was going to mess him up because you don't want to go on there and you don't want to have a yelling battle because you never wins. Nobody wants to watch you talk over each other. So I just waited for him to hang himself and then I just took up and tightened the noose on him, you know. And he couldn't slam me one bit. He just was like, so you want to raise my taxes, don't you? I said, yes, I do. Well, how much am I supposed to pay in taxes? 50%? I said, higher. 60? Higher. 70? Yeah, 70's good. You think people who make this money should pay that kind of tax? I said, no, that wasn't the question. I said, you should pay that. He's totally messed. He doesn't know where to go. Because he was winding himself up, you know, and then it goes... I stopped him halfway through one of his blowhard things. And I go, you're Irish Catholic, you're East Catholic? Yep, yep. Not just like me, right? Yeah? I said, don't you remember that lesson we were taught that we'd be judged by how we treat the least among us? He was like a deer then. He was like, yeah. He goes, because this is socialism. I said, geez, the nuns thought they called it Christianity. You know? I was like, he doesn't know where to go. What are you going to do with that? What are you going to do? Slam Christianity? You know?
Yeah.
You've obviously self-educated. Are there, like, writers that were particularly inspirational to you? I'm just curious.
There was this author. His name was John Holt. And he wrote a book called How Children Learn. And he wrote another book called How Children Fail. And he wrote some other books that when I was young, when I was a teenager, were kind of inspiring. I remember reading a book called Rules for Radicals by a guy named Saul Alinsky. I remember an underground book in high school called Student as Nigger, and it was a powerful book. You know, I don't know if you'd ever find it anywhere, but it was just kind of an eye-opening, you know, book. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by D. Brown, an early book I read as a teenager, Native Americans, that just kind of shocked me. This is before People's History of the United States, the kind of thing when you first read the other side of the story. You've been fed one side, you know, all through childhood. So those were all things that had an early influence on me. But I always read my parents taught me to read before I went to kindergarten. So I've always read the paper. You know, I read four or five papers a day. You gotta read like the Wall Street Journal. You gotta read like the enemy's papers. You know what they're up to. Yeah, well, there's another book called The Soft Revolution, and it's about using the techniques of judo instead of karate as political people. This guy John Holt, though. Anybody heard? Nobody's ever heard of him? He's an educator and wrote these. You know, nobody? How Children Learn and How Children Fail. You heard of him? Yeah. I went to hear him speak one time, and I'll leave you this because I just thought this sticks with me all the time, and it just. He said that I used to see my life as a political person, where I was on one train, and everybody whiningly over at the train going in the right direction, wishing they were on that train, and hold out my hand for them and help them over the train, stay on the train I'm on, and help the few over, and keep going, and keep moving forward. And I think that's the little parable I just thought was really, really important, because you'll burn yourself out politically if you constantly act in such a way where it's like, you know, I gotta change the world, we gotta do everything we can, stop, we can't give up, you know, and it's just like, you won't last long at that. At 18, you can pump it up for quite some time. By 30, you'll just be a sellout, like everybody else. You know, because you'll have burned out and you'll be turned off by the whole damn thing, or you'll just be a cynic. You'll just sit back in your cynicism and just, you know, you know?
Have you ever been threatened?
Threatened and how?
I mean, have you ever, like,
Just that reporter from the Springfield Business Journal. Other than that. No, I don't. No.